If every step you take is agonizing, you might need to see a doctor to diagnose the problem and prescribe something to relieve your pain. But of course, not all foot pain is the result of some serious injury or disease. Maybe it's just that your shoes are too tight. We all understand that some kinds of physical discomfort are just signals that we need to make a change. Maybe we should think that way about emotional pain as well. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Nobody likes to feel anxiety, which can run the gamut from vaguely irritating to almost unbearable. But persistent worry is not necessarily a sign that there's something wrong with us. And my guest says treating all anxiety like a disease makes it hard to tell the difference between healthy, functional angst that drives us to prepare for an uncertain future and anxiety disorders, which happen when our efforts to cope actually make us feel worse. Tracy Dennis Tiwari is professor of psychology and neuroscience at Hunter College, the City University of New York, where she directs the Emotion Regulation Lab, and she's co-founder of the digital therapeutics company Wise Therapeutics. Her book is called Future Tense: Why Anxiety is Good for You, Even Though It Feels Bad. Tracy, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. It's great to be with you.
What is anxiety exactly?
Well, anxiety feels like fear, but it's distinctly different. Fear lets us know that there is certain and present danger, and it prepares us to fight or take flight. But anxiety makes us into time travelers. It makes us into mental time travelers into the future, because it's that feeling that we get when we're apprehensive, nervous about the uncertain future. And the future is uncertain, not because something bad will necessarily happen, but because something bad could happen, but it hasn't happened yet, and something good could happen instead. So really, anxiety is the emotion that tells us there's this uncertainty in the future and prepares us to avert the bad things and make the good things into reality.
So is that what you mean when you call anxiety a triumph of human evolution?
Absolutely, because it relies on really one of the great achievements of human evolution. It's kind of right up there with the opposable thumb with evolution. And that's our ability to imagine in exquisite detail the future, to simulate it, to dream, and to create a story of what we want the future to be.
Are we somehow more likely to imagine that the future will be terrible than amazing?
I think that's a difference, you know, an individual difference that many of us have. I tend to be an inveterate optimist, for better or for worse. So I often imagine a future that's better than just meh. It's a pretty good future. I think the key to how we imagine the future, even if we sometimes are a bit pessimistic, you know, sometimes we want to prepare for bad things happening. So just because we think of negative potential futures, it doesn't mean that we have to be a negative people. But what we do want is to have flexibility. We want to have the ability to anticipate that something bad could happen, but also believe that we have the ability to make good things happen in our lives. And sometimes life is just really hard. I mean, if we didn't know that before the pandemic, we all know it now. And I think we all know it. And the key about what's making life particularly hard right now, I think, is that there's a heavy dose of uncertainty, of change, and a lot of us have had loss and real suffering. What anxiety helps us do is to understand that, yes, there have been some tough things we've been through. The future might have some risks, but we also care about the future. Anxiety, we only are anxious when we care. And we're only anxious when we believe that we can still affect change in the world. And so we do have the power to make good things happen again.
You have shared that you, even as an optimist, experienced a lot of understandable anxiety when your infant son was diagnosed with a heart condition. What did that anxiety do for you and for him before he was able to have this successful surgery to fix the problem?
Yes, that was one of the most anxiety-provoking experiences of my life. Yeah. And I felt that at that time, anxiety was really an ally to me. So we found out that my son was born with a congenital heart condition, but he was not quite born yet. I found out midway through my pregnancy. So that allowed me to prepare, my husband and myself and my family, to prepare for my son's treatment. Now, if I had despaired, which, you know, I had moments of despair, it wouldn't have allowed me to activate to persist and problem solve in what needed to happen now, which was to find the best doctor possible for my son so that when he was born, we would have care in place. It also meant that as a researcher, it helped me persist in doing the research. I actually got onto PubMed, which is where all the medical publications are listed, and I downloaded every single study that had ever been conducted on my son's heart condition, and I got to reading. And of course, as a scientist, that gave me some comfort because I was gaining knowledge. So I started to prepare myself. In the moments when I felt really concerned, and worried, it helped me, that is, anxiety helped me persist. It helped me problem solve and think outside the box. Because remember that anxiety, it does include the benefits of fear, which is the fight flight response. But anxiety is way beyond fear, fight, and flight, the three F's as I think of them. Anxiety primes us to focus on rewards and strive towards things we want. It even increases the neurotransmitter dopamine in our brain. And that's the feel-good hormone that not only happens when something that, you know, good happens, but it actually primes us to work towards positive goals. Anxiety also increases level of the social bonding hormone, oxytocin. And the social bonding hormone primes us to seek out social connection. And at that time, when we were so worried about my son's health, I needed all the friends and family and all the support I could get. So in these ways of, you know, anxiety helping me persist, to hope, to seek out support, to problem solve, anxiety helped me do all of those things at this really difficult moment in my life.
So I'm not a psychologist or a neuroscientist, but I don't think anybody would say that your anxiety around your son's heart condition that you found out about when you were still pregnant, that was not a disorder or a disease state, right? That was a normal worry that any parent would have. How common are diagnosed anxiety disorders in the modern world? And where's the line between normal, rational worry and a disorder?
Anxiety disorders are the most common mental health disorder, actually, in the United States and beyond. So a third of us, that's one third, that's over 100 million people in the United States alone, will be diagnosed with an anxiety disorder in our lifetime, or experiencing such debilitating anxiety that it's getting in the way of living life well. Now, here's where the difference between anxiety and an anxiety disorder is very crucial, because I would never underestimate the suffering that anxiety disorders cause by saying, hey, anxiety can be something that can be an ally, you know, because an anxiety disorder is by definition, it's not just having too much anxiety or intense anxiety. By definition, an anxiety disorder is that the ways we cope with that intense anxiety are getting in the way of living well. So for example, if we're anxious about social judgment or performing well, or you know, maybe we're a kid and we're starting to have a lot of test anxiety. Having the intense anxiety is not enough to diagnose the disorder. But if we start to call in sick at work or to school, we don't want to go to school anymore because we fear failing the test. If we're anxious about our performance at work and we start to not take on new assignments, or actually even start to feel that we're not up to the job and quit our job, you know, those are the kinds of coping with our anxious feelings, getting in the way of living a full life. That's when an anxiety disorder is diagnosed. And so what I'm saying in this book is, yes, anxiety disorders need treatment and support, but if we treat all anxiety like a disorder that we avoid and eradicate and fear, we're actually going to start doing unhelpful things when it comes to anxiety and spiral our anxiety even more intensely out of control.
So how would our kind of cultural training to think of almost all anxious feelings as possibly the product of a disease state warp the ways we find to respond to that anxiety?
So when we treat anxiety as a disease, or let's even turn that down a notch and say that we think of anxiety as a sign that something is wrong. It's a dangerous feeling, say, we believe, or that it's a malfunction and needs to be fixed. Well, the first thing we start doing is we try to make anxiety go away. We try to either fix it, right, avoid it, or suppress it. The problem is that when we immediately try to suppress or avoid or eradicate feelings of anxiety, they almost always grow stronger. It can be compared to the what sometimes is called the white bear phenomenon. You know, tell someone, don't think of a white bear. And without exception, you will think of a white bear. Our emotions are the same way, because not only do the more that we suppress them, not only, you know, do they bounce back more, but it's an opportunity cost, because difficult emotions are meant to be difficult. They're meant to make us sit up and pay attention so that we can listen to the information they provide. And then when it's time, work through those feelings and gain skills in working through those feelings like any other skill. But when we treat all signs of anxiety, which is on the spectrum from just a little nervous to, yes, full-blown panic, when we treat all of that the same as a danger signal, then we lose those opportunities to learn to actually cope and then actually tune in and see how anxiety can help us persist and be creative and give us really important information about our life.
I want to go back to something you mentioned, which is the role of dopamine in our experience of anxiety. As a layperson, rather than a scientist, I've come to associate dopamine with good feelings only. So how does this hormone play into our anxious feelings?
And isn't it fascinating?
Yeah.
Because we don't even, well, first of all, scientists were so, we were so kind of hooked on this idea that anxiety was all about threat and threat detection and fight and flight, that for many decades, we didn't even look for these associations. The questions you ask make a difference, you know? So only in the past 10 or 15 years have we documented that dopamine, this feel-good hormone, you know, it's kind of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And the dark side we always thought was, well, you know, and then it's involved in addiction. And so we think of it this way. But we found in just the past 10 or 15 years that when we're anxious, it also increases dopamine. Now, dopamine, like any neurotransmitter in the brain, is like this little information messenger. So it shuttles information from one area of your brain to the other. So dopamine is crucial for helping different parts of our brain work together to pursue rewarding positive outcomes so that our memories, our instincts, and our decision-making can all work together integrated in tandem, because dopamine is sharing information across these brain regions. So dopamine can make our whole brain more efficient in order to work towards and strive towards the outcomes we want. So the fact that anxiety increases this neurotransmitter just tells us that just as much as it's there to protect us from potential danger, it's also there to help us work to make our dreams come true.
Could that dopamine play a role in the ways that some people, and this is not to blame people suffering from anxiety, but some people do seem to sort of get hooked on that feeling, do not really want much to do with positive, constructive steps to fix it. They just, the only place they can go with their brains is to continue to ruminate.
I think there is that danger, and whether or not dopamine underlies that is a little unclear because the science is young. But here's, I'd like to be really clear about this analogy between anxiety and addiction. It really doesn't hold, because even if dopamine is increased when we're anxious, as soon as we take action based on that anxiety, our brain knows it and anxiety starts to go down, because anxiety, again, is priming us to do something. It's like energy, it needs to go somewhere. So if we're worried about something at work, we wake up in the morning and it's going through our head, oh, my relationship with my coworker has just been going off the rails. As soon as you decide to do something about that, maybe have that difficult conversation, your anxiety will decrease, and so will your dopamine and all sorts of other biological responses, which means you know that you're on the right track, because anxiety is unpleasant. As it increases, we have to pay attention to it. That's why it's designed to be unpleasant. And then as we pay attention to it and see that it's going down, it tells us, hey, we're doing the right thing. This is in the right direction. Now, that's not to say that this healthy process can't be hijacked by an anxiety disorder. And sometimes we do start to believe that we need our anxiety to do anything in our life. It's sort of as if anxiety contains within itself its own solutions. So you listen to anxiety, you give it a chance, you assume it's not a malfunction for a minute, listen to what it's telling you. You know, it's messy being human. There are lots of messy feelings. So that when we listen to it, we can say, okay, there's information. And when I take an action based on that information, anxiety starts to go down. And so by having this attitude about anxiety, that it's an ally, albeit one that we have to negotiate with, we can start to track what it's telling us about the things we care about in the world, how we can act to make things better. And then when it goes down and decreases, we know that we are often on the right track.
So anxiety can help us through a crisis when it's critical that we find some sort of solution to an urgent problem. What's the relationship between anxiety and creativity?
Anxiety and creativity inhabit the same space in a way, because anxiety is that bridge between where we are now and where it's possible to be in the future, both the good and the bad. And creativity is also all about future possibilities. It's about making something that's never existed before. And that can be everything from a great work of art to a ham sandwich. So what happens when we're anxious is, because it's putting us into this future orientation, it's actually helping us persist beyond obstacles we may face. It helps us think outside the box and be more innovative. There was a great study by DeDrew and colleagues a handful of years ago where they showed that when they made people moderately anxious by having them do a writing task that made them remember something anxiety-provoking in their life, and then gave them a difficult problem-solving task, people who were anxious compared to not feeling so anxious, they were more activated. They persisted longer in problem-solving, they came up with more solutions, and they came up with higher quality solutions.
So I'm curious about the challenges of studying anxiety in a laboratory setting. You mentioned, you know, making people a little nervous about a writing task. What else can you do to stimulate anxiety in a research subject without causing any kind of lasting harm?
Yeah, it does always feel a little evil scientist when I describe these studies. And when you study difficult emotions, you make people feel those feelings a little. I mean, the first thing is to always check in with someone as you're, you know, making sure they're fully consented to what's going to happen. And then also at the end, really debrief people and make sure they're in a good place. So all of us are very careful about that and really taking care of participants in research. But I'll give you the example of a study that really showed the power of creating a difficult feeling in someone when it came to anxiety. These were socially anxious people, so diagnosed with a social anxiety disorder, where the key fear in a social anxiety disorder is of social judgment and humiliation. And this was a study that came out of Harvard in 2013 by Jameson and colleagues. And they asked these folks to then do something that is sheer kryptonite for people who are socially anxious. They asked them to give an impromptu public speech in front of a panel of judges on a contentious topic like the death penalty. And half of the people, they were just sort of thrown into the deep end and said, okay, get ready. You have 2 minutes. Give this speech. But the other half of these socially anxious people, they were taught something unique about anxiety. They were taught that, you know, you're going to feel anxiety before you do this. Your heart's going to beat. You're going to sweat, all the butterflies in your stomach. But this is actually your body preparing to perform at its best. It's your heart pumping blood and oxygen to your brain so you can focus. And humans have evolved to have this response so that we can perform at peak. And here are a few studies to show you that that's the case. So then they measured people's heart rate and blood pressure and their performance during the public speech. And they measured this in the folks who were taught to think of anxiety as an ally. And then they measured it in the people who weren't taught anything new about anxiety. And they found something fascinating. They found that the people who were taught to reconsider what their anxiety was actually preparing them to do, that it was a good and helpful thing, their blood pressure was lower, their heart rate was steadier, and they performed better with fewer ums and ahs and stutters. And so by believing anxiety could be helpful, their body was actually even on the biological level, better able to prepare and perform well under pressure. So that's sort of an evil scientist study, but it shows how a slight mind shift in our approach to anxiety can have a big positive impact.
To the extent that you would be sort of ethically obligated to help research subjects leave behind that temporary anxiety you caused before they leave the lab setting, it sounds like maybe we're onto something here. We can all use that information that you give your research subjects to understand our own anxiety.
That's a beautiful connection. That's right. I think that if we, and really this is the purpose of writing my book, to ask people to consider to do a slight mindset shift when it comes to anxiety, so that now instead of thinking it as a failure of some, you know, standard of perfection and positivity, instead of a failure, instead of a disease or malfunction, we start to think of it as an ally. And yes, one we do have to negotiate with and work with, but one that can help us figure out what we care about in the world, one that activates us to pursue our dreams, to problem solve, one that actually can even prime us to seek out more social connection and focus more on things and rewards that we care about in the world. So I do believe that we can, like in this study, make these little mindset shifts and start to approach anxiety in more helpful ways, understand when it's healthy and maybe when it's not healthy, and seek support when we need that extra support.
Tracy, what's the difference between what I would call like situational anxiety, right? Worrying about an upcoming test or a tax audit, and chronic anxiety?
I think chronic anxiety can include some specific anxiety, but often there's this unpleasant mix of free-floating anxiety, right? Where you sort of, you wake up at, I don't know, this was just a couple days ago, this happened to me, I woke up at 5 a.m., just all these worries, sort of kind of not really sure sometimes even what they were about, just an icky, yucky feeling. And so often when we have chronic anxiety, we have this mix of, you know, oh yes, this is understandable. I'm worried about those doctor results, whether or not I have cancer. Like, that's very clear anxiety. And then we have this free-floating anxiety. Part of the reason we have a lot of free-floating anxiety today is that there's so much uncertainty, that we have a lot of change happening. But the thing that we can do when we shift our mindset about anxiety is to say, okay, this feels really bad, but it's meant to feel bad. And I can actually, I have the ability to tune in to these feelings. They're not out of my control. I can take some time and listen to them. Is it telling me something about the world, or is it really very truthfully useless anxiety at this time? And if it's useless, there are a whole series of things that we can do after we've tuned in and listened to anxiety to feel better and or to work with that anxiety. In a nutshell, a lot of those things that are helpful to us are about re-entering the present moment, because anxiety, again, sends us into the future. So a lot of us love to exercise. You know, that's one of the best ways to just take a little bit of the pressure off, leave the future tense behind for the moment, and just, you know, do something that's healthy for your body and your mind. A lot of people want to see friends. Maybe they have a therapist that they go to, or a counselor, or a religious counselor that is a really supportive, great person for them. Sometimes when we leave anxiety behind, we need to make those social connections and seek those social support. The list is endless, but the trick is knowing that after we give anxiety a shot to see if it does tell us anything useful, that we have tools in our toolkit to do something with it if it's not.
Since you mentioned waking up at 5 in the morning, I'll go ahead and ask this. I don't know whether you cover it in the book, but, you know, there's something, I don't think of myself as an anxious person at all. But if I wake up at 2:30 in the morning and find it difficult to get back asleep, my brain is just flooded with worries that I know that in the light of day really don't seem to bother me. Is there something about the chemistry while we're sleeping that causes us to feel particular anxiety when we awaken at an odd time?
I think it's a really interesting question. I think part of it is that our defenses are down. So if we, you know, and it happens to me then too, because like, yeah, I'm managing all this. I'm an expert on anxiety. I wrote the book, but you know, but then it's 2 a.m. or 5 a.m. And what I believe at those moments is that actually most of the time, anxiety is telling us that something, it's telling us that there's something we need to take care of, that there's something we care about in the world that's not quite right. And this happened to me just very recently with some work-related worries. It was just something that wasn't feeling right with about my relationship with my colleague. And I was just sort of sweeping it under the rug, and I think it's fine. But it kept on happening a couple mornings in a row. And, you know, I started to listen to it. And when I did, I made a plan. I made a plan to have that difficult conversation. Sometimes when I wake up in the wee hours and I'm not sure what's going on, I make little lists of things I want to check in on. Oh, I was worried about that thing at my daughter's school. Maybe I need to reach out to the teacher about that. You know, you just make a list. If anxiety and emotions are energy, they need to go someplace. So just putting a little plan in action is often enough for us to actually alleviate anxiety a bit. And again, know that we're on the right track and we have something that we're doing with this information. And when we honor anxiety in that way and think of it as an ally, I think most of the time it will give us some useful information.
Are there particular factors that make some people more vulnerable to chronic anxiety than others?
I think when we learn as a kind of habitual way of coping to avoid unpleasant feelings, to sweep them under the rug and suppress them, I think that actually sets us up to have more problems with anxiety. And there's good evidence to show that. I think when we teach our kids that anxiety is a dangerous feeling and we try with all the best intentions to prevent any uncomfortable situations for our kids, that's an opportunity cost because it prevents them from learning the skills to cope with anxiety. One of the most exciting new treatments right now coming out of the Yale Child Study Center for childhood clinical anxiety is something called, it's, oh, I'm
Space.
Forgetting the acronym for, thank you.
Yes. What does that stand
for?
And
I write about it in the book. Oh, it stands for supportive parenting of anxious children. And the whole premise of it is simply that when our kids are anxious, we, with the best of intentions, over accommodate them. We try to make the hurt go away immediately. We don't help them go through the anxiety. We try to help them go around it. So if they're, you know, scared of going to school or sleeping alone, we sleep with them every night and we don't make them go to school anymore. But the problem is, of course, that leads to even more child anxiety and it prevents them from learning how to cope. So when we actually, with our kids, start to help them through rather than around, and that's what space does. It helps parents learn how to gradually but very supportively help their kids work through the anxious experience. You have to stop sleeping with them every night. You help them gradually go to school again, even if they're very anxious. But that, after just 6 weeks of that learning, kids whose parents learn to do this, they show clinical reductions in anxiety comparable to when kids themselves receive cognitive behavioral therapy. So it's this very powerful approach we can use with ourselves, we can use with our kids, figuring out how to work with instead of preventing and eradicating all anxiety.
It's really interesting to think about parents in this situation because it is so painful to see a little one freaking out over something. And so many times it's easier to just, you know, if they're afraid of dogs, cross the street to get away from the dogs so that they don't have a meltdown. What are some ways, short of going through this special therapy program for a child with a documented anxiety problem, what are some ways parents can help their kids to learn that they have the ability actually to cope with anxious feelings?
I think in some ways it's one of the hardest things, and I'm a mom, so I know how hard it is. But it's also one of the simplest things because it starts with us. We parents are anxious about our kids' anxiety. And as you said, we just don't want to see them suffer. We want them to be okay. And these are very uncertain times, and so we want to protect our kids. But when we are curious about anxiety, we can teach our kids to be a little more curious about it so that we know, hey, you know, sometimes I am going to cross the street and not make them go by that snarling dog. And, you know, it's just, you know, you don't have to white knuckle it through every time. But if there's an opportunity to help them gain experience, to help them gain confidence, just think what we're doing for our kids. We're helping them gain mastery. We're helping them gain confidence. And nothing great ever happened in the comfort zone. We know that, whether it's physical fitness, whether it's creative ideas, or whether it's just learning how to deal with your fear of dogs, we have to be a little uncomfortable to learn to work through the discomfort of life. And it's not going to be a comfortable life. There is no life. There's no one in the world that has a perfectly comfortable life. So by us realizing that we can actually strengthen our kids, help them feel good by helping them know how to feel bad, that will go a long way to figuring out what to do right as a parent, and really, honestly, to trusting our own gut instincts a little bit more instead of feeling like there's some parenting, perfect parent checklist that we have to, you know, we have to check off 20 out of 20 boxes on all the time.
So some families of anxious kids were relieved when, you know, school districts around the country went virtual at the start of the pandemic. Their kids had a lot of anxiety around school. Some of these families have sought to make virtual school a permanent option for their kids. What I've wondered is what happens at the end of that when they sort of finish with high school and have not been required to sort of live through these anxieties? Will they magically be cured upon adulthood, or will they be anxious people forever?
Well, you never know because people are very resilient, but you are stacking the deck against your child if you don't help them. Again, you don't have to throw them in the deep end, but if you don't help and support them in facing those anxieties and getting back to this, back to school and all the challenges that it entails little by little. You know, we think of our kids as fragile, like china teacups that you drop the teacup and it smashes into a million pieces. But we actually are, the science, the clinical experience, everything else tells us that kids are not fragile. Kids are actually anti-fragile, which is the phrase that the writer Nassim Nicholas Taleb coined to show that something that's anti-fragile actually gains from being challenged. Muscles, you have to work them and strain them a little bit for muscles to build and grow strong. Otherwise, muscles atrophy. The immune system, you have to expose the immune system to bacteria and viruses and germs for it to actually learn to mount an immune response. And our kids' emotional lives are the same. They have to be exposed to difficult emotions to learn to cope with them and transform them into really what it takes to be a human in this world, a person who has confidence, who can handle stress and get through and come out stronger on the other side.
Tracy, lots of people, we've talked about children, lots of people are really concerned about the rise in documented cases of anxiety among teenagers in the US. And we look around, like, what has changed in recent years? And we see that they're spending a lot more time on social media. It's easy to assume this must be driving this increase in adolescent anxiety. What makes you think the reality may be quite a bit more nuanced than that?
I think that we do assume, because of these correlations, right, that our world has changed radically just over the past 10 or 12 years because of digital mobile technology, social media. I don't think you have to be a researcher to say there are lots of bad things about social media. I personally have no love for the way that social media have evolved because, you know, they haven't evolved to really serve humans. They've evolved to serve the bottom line of these tech companies. So they do things that are very unhealthy for human beings. So we can say all that, but at the same time, there are no real convincing, compelling studies to show that all things being equal, you put one kid on social media and say another kid doesn't go on social media, and that kid on social media is going to do worse, that it's this direct causal effect. The reason we don't have those simple findings is because, well, you can't really do that experiment, thankfully, but also it's much more nuanced than that. It's much more complex than all social media or technology is bad, because if all social media were truly bad and there was nothing positive about it, then the only solution would be to never let anyone ever get on it again. And the truth is, that's not going to happen. Instead, what we see is that there are many facets to social media use, like there are facets to any other kind of consumption, like nutrition. There's healthy ways to eat and there are unhealthy ways to eat. And I believe the same goes for social media. We also assume that there's something magical about technology where the things that happen on social media, because they are more amplified, true, and they happen faster, that it's as if it's taken out of the reality of our day-to-day lives. But the truth is that kids, for example, are going to socially compare themselves to others. That is what it means to be a teenager. It can happen problematically on social media platforms because now you're comparing yourself to thousands, millions of people. Everyone is more beautiful and skinnier and every this and that than you are because, of course, nothing is real on social media. So that can be problematic, but that doesn't mean that social media causes eating disorders, depression, or anxiety. It means that we have to teach our kids to use social media in ways that are healthy. They know what's reality and what's not reality. And they spend lots of time off social media so that they're also face to face in the real world.
What kind of social support is most helpful to people coping with anxiety?
The social support that's most helpful is actually not the kind that we tend to get on social media, to speak of that again, because social media is good with bridging connection. This is sort of this idea of social capital. It's really good with bridging, like you can make interesting connections and be creative and share, but it's not good with bonding. Bonding are social connections that we have evolved to have, where we seek out meaning, purpose, social connection to others as a way to make sense of our lives, to seek support, and to actually do emotional outsourcing, to actually not do as much work emotionally because we have others to help us. There's a great study that was published, oh gosh, about a decade or so ago now, out of University of Wisconsin. It was a sort of famous study at the time. It was the hand-holding study. They brought people into the lab, they imaged their brain just before they were about to receive a painful shock. They were told, okay, you're going to re receive this painful shock. This is another evil scientist experiment, right? Except they had three different situations. One, the person was alone. The other, they held the hand of a stranger. And the third condition, they held the hand of a loved one. And don't you know that when they looked at the brains of people who were able to hold the hand of a loved one, their brains, especially the circuits that are involved in being anxious, detecting threat, doing all the hard work of handling those emotions, those areas of the brain were calmer. Essentially, the anxious brain was soothed just by virtue of holding a loved one's hand. Even the hand of a stranger helped them calm the anxious brain, requiring them to do less work to handle this challenge facing this kind of potentially painful shock. So that's just a small example of how we are primed and seek out and ready to benefit from the connection we get from loved ones and from that outsourcing of emotional support.
We associate anxiety with worry that we experience within our brains, but of course, it can also often cause these physiological symptoms that we're familiar with, right? The dry mouth and the racing heartbeat and other kinds of symptoms. How can understanding the physiological processes of anxiety help us to reframe the way we interpret those very sensations?
Anxiety is this incredible harness. It harnesses our memories, our thoughts, and our biology at every level. And so what it's doing when it makes us feel those butterflies in our stomach, again, it's on, anxiety is this spectrum, so it's on this dimmer switch. It's not a light switch that you flick on and off. You can feel it just as those butterflies in your stomach biologically. Your heart is racing. Oh, let's turn up the dial a little. Now maybe you're even sweating a little bit. But the way we have to understand that is that it's working to prepare you to navigate the uncertainty of the world in a way that's going to be an advantage to you. So when your heart races, just like those socially anxious folks going into the challenging, impromptu public speech, when our hearts are racing, the heart is actually pumping blood and oxygen to our brain. We are sharper and more focused. Anxiety, unlike feelings like sadness, is actually more of an activating emotion. It's moving us forward. It's allowing us to actually deal with whatever's happening in the moment. Because it's triggering other biological responses, these sort of the surprising biology of anxiety that we talked about before with dopamine and oxytocin. It's also activating us and priming us to be more in the world, more connected. It's almost like it contains within itself its own solutions. So when we think of our biological response not as a warning alarm going off, ding, 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 but rather as the starter to a race, right? Like the alarm that goes off, the gun that goes off when we're about to run a race, that can shift everything from how we experience those feelings and what we're able to take away and do with all of those feelings.
Tracy, it can be so hard to find the humor in anything when we are feeling particularly anxious. What is the value of attempting to laugh a little when we're really worried about something?
I think when we laugh a little, it's actually for me, and I do laugh a lot, I find, when it comes to, and even now, when it comes to difficult things in my life. And I've thought about that lately, and I think what it is it's acknowledging that being human is not about optimizing every moment and being perfectly productive all the time and never failing. Being human is about being messy. It's about riding the waves of our ups and downs and life throwing us curveballs. And so when we have that little bit of humor when we face something difficult, I think it allows us to acknowledge and see the reality of the messiness of being human. But that's also part of the beauty of being human. It allows us to be curious. It allows us, someone once told me, actually not too long ago, we were talking about the message of my book. And they said, after reading your book, I felt a little proud of my anxiety. And I have to tell you, that was one of the loveliest things I've heard, that one of the loveliest things someone has said to me. Because what that showed me is that they were more accepting of that part of their humanity. So I think when we laugh a little, we both let go of this feeling of doom and gloom. We break outside of that, but also just embrace what it means to be a human being on this planet.
I think most of us have heard the term and understand what perfectionism is. What's the difference between perfectionism and what you call excellentism?
Oh, it's a very it's if you're a sci-fi nerd like I am, it's like the difference between the dark side and the light side. There's a big difference. So perfectionism, as we all know, is this really painfully punishing standard of flawlessness. That unless you do 120% every single time, you're a failure. It's black and white. There's no in between. Excellencism is the opposite of that because it's the belief that it's worth striving for excellence. It's worth really doing your best. But you also know that failing is part of that journey, that you can't ever get to excellence without failure. And it's also the belief that you have what it takes to get there. A lot of people, especially women, I think, have been taught that unless, we're Little Miss Perfect or Little Mr. Perfect, it just isn't good enough. You have to have those 20 balls in the air and you have to keep them going at all times. And what excellence shows us is that sometimes having a ball drop is on the path to doing absolutely amazing things in the world. And it just so turns out that people who are excellencists tend to be more average, more anxious on average than the rest of us who aren't quite so striving or believing that they can make good things happen. So anxiety and pursuing excellence is actually part and parcel of each other. And it has none of the downsides of perfectionism, which include debilitating anxiety and depression. People who are really perfectionists over the course of their life, unfortunately, have higher risk of suicidal thoughts and intent. It's a very destructive tendency to have, but excellencism helps us do the best that we can, and it doesn't have all those downsides.
There are now a lot of medications available, right, to people who are deeply troubled by anxiety. When is it appropriate for people to use these, and when might those medications have the effect of actually making us less capable of developing useful coping strategies?
For many people, anti-anxiety medications, most of which are benzodiazepines, which are very, very intense medications, many people can benefit from benzodiazepines. However, and this is a big however, they were intended, and all the research shows that they're only truly beneficial when used temporarily over just a few months, and in combination with other therapeutic interventions like cognitive behavioral therapy. That is when they are effective. It's sort of like the analogy, like the old adage, the biblical adage of give a person a fish and they'll eat for a day, teach them to fish and they'll eat for a lifetime. Well, medication is the fish. It's a temporary solution. Therapy, like cognitive behavioral therapy and science-based therapies, that's learning how to fish. It's skill building. So what happens when we take a benzodiazepine is that it helps bring us back down to a baseline where if we're overwhelmed by anxiety, we just cannot cope at this point in our lives. It brings those feelings down, and then we can cope better and also benefit from other treatment approaches and learn new skills. So that's what it's meant to do. Unfortunately, it's overprescribed. People are not told of the dangers of benzodiazepines, which include overdose and death, especially when you combine them with other drugs. And they're not told that really it's meant to be this temporary solution, and you should use it cautiously and then titrate off it cautiously as well.
So if I have some anxiety that my roof might leak the next time it's supposed to rain, and that drives me to get up on the roof and, fix the shingles or nail something over it, I have coped with my anxiety. But maybe I take those steps, the best possible steps I can take, and then I find myself still worrying. What if I didn't nail the shingles tight enough? What if the tarp blows off? What do we do for ourselves when we have taken steps to alleviate our anxiety and it still continues to haunt us in ways that disrupt the rest of our lives?
Right, that's the point at which. So if you keep on getting up on that roof and now the hurricane's coming and you're up there and the hurricane's, going and you're still on the roof, this is a good sign that anxiety is not working for you, that the way that you're coping with it, not being able to let go of those worries, it's starting to become a vicious cycle. That's a great sign that it might be time to seek out therapeutic support. Now, if you can get a, there's still problems with accessing mental health treatments. That is still hard for many people, but there are great treatments out there. There are great digital therapeutics out there as well, and there's great telehealth now, and that was something the pandemic really made even better. So seek out that help, seek out that support. Don't feel like you have to go right to medication. That might be a solution for some people, but it is not the solution for everyone. And so again, but that's you paying attention to your anxiety and saying, you know, this got in the way for me. And it just didn't happen once. It happened two times, 20 times. It's a persistent problem. That's the point, the tipping point at which it really might mean that you can seek additional support. And this is becoming an anxiety disorder.
Tracy Dennis-Tawari is professor of psychology and neuroscience at Hunter College, the City University of New York, where she directs the Emotion Regulation Lab. She's co-founder of the digital therapeutics company Wise Therapeutics, and she is author of Future Tense, Why Anxiety is Good for You Even Though It Feels Bad. Tracy, this has been really interesting. Thanks very much for making time for us.
Chris, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. Subscribe to our podcast wherever you get podcasts by searching for KERA Think, or check it out on our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.